Hello, on this week's program, David Patrick Stern speaks with Curtis Institute of Music students who'll debut as concerto soloists with the Philadelphia Orchestra this summer. Susan Lewis looks at skyscrapers and spectacles, the subjects of two summertime exhibitions drawn from the Philadelphia Museum of Art's collection of prints, photography and works on paper. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Ephrata Cloister in Lancaster County, one of America's earliest religious communities. And we'll listen back to a conversation with Morris Arboretum artist-in-residence Patrick Doherty as he worked on a now-completed sculpture of interwoven tree branches, twigs and saplings. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
For Philadelphia Orchestra audiences, the Mann Center for the Performing Arts is a place of recreation. For a handful of Curtis Institute of Music students, it's an adventure that takes them far from the safety of their practice rooms to a large, semi-outdoor performance space. Six of them will make their Philadelphia Orchestra debuts at the Mann Center in the coming week, in a plan that started when the orchestra initially thought it couldn't afford to play its entire regular season there, and the Mann management huddled with their counterparts at Curtis to see what might fill the void. What came out of it was a great collaboration. The orchestra gets up-and-coming soloists on short notice, and the Curtis students have a major orchestra debut. Now the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns takes a look at what seems to be a win-win situation for everybody.
No matter that time is short for 14-year-old Taiwanese violinist Yu Chen-Zeng, in preparation for his first-ever performance of Vivaldi's Four Seasons in his U.S. concerto debut. He learned the notes some 4 years ago and is now in the process of determining what ornaments didn't make it onto the page and what they should sound like.
The original part is like...
What he's not sure about is the intoxicated peasant portrayed in the Autumn Concerto. That's one part of life Zeng has yet to experience.
Well, I haven't been drunk before, but my Miss Coffin told me to not be too, in tempo.
The more important learning experience lies beyond the nurturing, old-world environs of the Curtis Institute. Even at the level of the Philadelphia Orchestra, summer concert seasons can be rough and tumble, with a new program every day and rehearsals consisting of a single run-through. The Mann is large, and not just in terms of seats, which are 4,700, not counting the lawn where audiences picnic. The ceiling seems to tower over the orchestra, making a lot of space to fill with sound, even with artificial amplification. The cooling system on stage can only do so much on those hot summer nights. 19-year-old violinist Benjamin Bielman would normally have ambitions to play a 35-minute concerto rather than a 10-minute romance. But under the circumstances, the romance is good for starters.
I can deal with humidity, heat. I don't mind if I sweat. You know, I really don't care. I guess it's my violin I'm most concerned about, and I'm going to make sure it's as tuned up as possible as it can be.
This arrangement came about when the Philadelphia Orchestra looked at its finances and decided it couldn't afford to present itself for its season of usual length at the Mann Center. A curtailed season was even announced. But before the Mann Center opted to present the orchestra tapping its own budget, the center's CEO, Catherine Cahill, met with Curtis President Roberto Diaz for conversations that boiled down to help. Though one typically thinks of students having time on their hands, the ones at Curtis are almost as busy performing and touring as the graduates. With the Philadelphia Orchestra dates reinstated, the next question was concerto soloists, and for a Philadelphia Orchestra opportunity, the students began maneuvering with their repertoire and with their teachers sticking with them after the term had ended. Let's not assume that the Curtis Institute is dumping its kids into the deep end of the pool without due consideration, says Diaz.
And so you talk to the faculty and say, who do you have who can take advantage of this possibility and make the best of it? I mean, we have so many students, or we're so fortunate that we have so many students that are able to do these concerts, you know, that we have the complete confidence in their abilities, so that it's really repertoire driven more than anything else, and availability.
Such arrangements have worked for others. Astro Artists has a longtime association with Camden's Symphony in C, deserving artists such as Simona Dinnerstein and Natalie Chu being given much-needed concerto exposure that put careers on a different level. However, Astro Artists have three or four rehearsals. Doing it in one, says Benjamin Bielman, requires a different kind of music making.
It forces you to be much more firm in what you believe and what you're doing with the music. You know, you have to really show it immediately, be very clear, because you have so little time.
The violinists will take care of themselves. The real problem might be the audience or lack thereof. The man crowd is not the same people who go to the Kimmel and might suffer from the kind of perceptions that keep them at home. Casual classical music lovers depend on the brand names to deliver what they're assured is the deluxe experience, one that makes the drive to Fairmount Park, the ticket price, the unpaved parking, all worth it. Even if any given superstar has a bad night, the charisma factor makes listeners focus all the harder on great music, and there's a lot of gratification in that. But for me, one of the very greatest things about Philadelphia is its huge number of talented young artists. One can't expect great depth and wisdom from their playing, but there's something irresistibly unfiltered about their emotional responses to even the most worn-out warhorses. They're discovering this music for the first time, and when they discover it anew, so do we.
The Philadelphian Choir's David Patrick Stearns. Curtis Institute of Music students performing with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Center include violinist Benjamin Bielman and pianist Kiyu Yeon Kima on Monday, pianists Christina and Michelle Naughton on Tuesday. Wednesday's concert features violinist Yu Qian Tseng and Leo Kyokman conducting from the harpsichord. Printmaking, photography, and other works on paper have been used to both record and challenge our perceptions of the world. At the Philadelphia Museum of Art this summer, two exhibitions offer views of different surroundings, one focused on city towers, the other on eye-catching gatherings of human beings. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers skyscrapers and spectacles.
In the first half of the 20th century, cities grew not only out, but up. Skyscrapers redefined skylines and became new subjects for artists, who were drawn to these concrete towers, in part because they were new and exciting,
and possibly in part just because it's part of their surroundings.
Curatorial fellow John Vick has selected about 55 works from the museum's collection of prints, photographs, and works on paper. They demonstrate the variety of artistic responses between 1908 and 1941, when the proliferation of skyscrapers dramatically changed the urban landscape. Some pictures document the structures almost like portraits, says Vick, pointing to a 1932 Earl Horder etching of Philadelphia's PSFS building.
It shows the architecture of the building, which was very, very, very revolutionary at the time. The PSFS building is the first skyscraper to embody the principles of the international style that is characterized by asymmetrical plans, open spaces, and most obviously with the PSFS building, an elimination of any sort of decorative work.
The early rise of skyscrapers coincided with New York's Armory Show of 1913, an international show of modern art. Philadelphia Museum of Art curator of prints John Itman says the neo-Gothic style Woolworth Building, represented in several images in this show, became the tallest building in the world when it was completed that same year.
It's interesting how modern that building seemed to artists at that time. It looks a bit dated today in that its format imitated the European Gothic cathedral style, as did many of the early skyscrapers. It's as though they were Gothic cathedrals on steroids.
Artists drew parallels with European cathedrals in ideological as well as visual terms, says John Vick, as skyscrapers were seen as symbols of American values.
If old world Europe was focused on the church, financially, but also in terms of ideology, then in modern America, it's enterprise, it's capitalism, it's business. That's the driving force in the country.
Values considered positive by some and dark, even dangerous by others. Vic displays together a set of drawings by Abraham Wolkowitz.
They show skyscrapers rising up from the ground in a single mass that appears rather unstable, crowded. Surrounding these buildings are what look like vultures, and beneath it are hordes of people kind of writhing around.
Below which is a print by Gerald Geerlings, with faint imagery above the Chicago skyline.
You see what the artist pictures as the future city, where skyscrapers are even taller. They're connected by aqueducts, terraces, little bridges between the two. And it's a very visionary, optimistic view of what the new city will look like. It's an architect's dream of sorts.
As skyscrapers became sleeker and more streamlined, some artists used them to explore abstraction, making collages from multiple images, or playing with reflections in photographs shot through glass. The towers became not only subjects themselves, from their heights they also provided new vistas. John Vick and John Ittman consider Bernice Abbott's 1932 shot of New York City at night, taken from the Empire State Building, looking down at Herald Square.
And this intersection of streets and skyscrapers and cubistic forms and illumination at night is very inventive in terms of its aesthetics and looks very abstract in its presentation.
The Empire State Building in that picture almost becomes a subject without even being visible, because that picture never would have been possible without it being there.
Indispensable subjects outside the picture frame play an important role in the adjacent exhibition of photographs called Spectacle, where a number of works show people looking at something beyond our view. Curatorial fellow Julia Dolan has gathered photographs that relate in some way to the idea of spectacle, which she says is a broad concept.
The actual definition indicates it's something exhibited to view, something unusual, notable, or entertaining. It can be a funeral, it can be a protest, it can be just a beautiful sight in the natural world, but it doesn't have to be something that we might normally use the word spectacular for.
Themes include man-made or natural sights, as well as people who attract attention. But many shots are of the spectators themselves. As a key image, Dolan points to Leif Friedlander's Mount Rushmore, a shot in which the famous landmark is seen only in its reflection through the glass of the visitor center, where tourists can be seen in random states of interest or disinterest.
They're not necessarily paying attention. They've made this long pilgrimage. Maybe they're tired. Maybe they're bored. Maybe it's not as interesting as they thought it would be.
Some photographs depict spectators at group events, such as a mummer's parade or a funeral during World War II, or a line of people in the Soviet Union waiting to be baptized after the lifting of restrictions on religion. Others capture random moments in time, as in the street shot of a heart attack victim by William Klein.
He's not only photographing the heart attack victim, but he's photographing the spectators. And one of the spectators is eating. Another one over here is smoking a cigarette. And then others are looking at the photographer, not necessarily the incident. So why are they there and how do they add to the situation? So I think in some ways it's a comment on how we do act as spectators.
Dolan says photography can make the viewer feel like a part of the scene. Vatican No. 2 by Christopher James is taken so close to the people in a crowd that we can only guess from the title, the black garments, and a hand clutching a piece of paper with the word Yesu that we're looking at nuns. Sometimes the photographer himself becomes part of the spectacle, as in Stuart Rome's image of a Haitian festival in which a woman dancing in a trance reaches out to the camera.
And she beckons him to dance with her, and we can see that he has become the spectacle and the spectators surround them. So in some ways it almost makes us feel as if we've become part of the spectacle and are surrounded by spectators.
Drawing us in is presumably the goal of all of these pictures. They suggest that the experience of the moment is made stronger by witnessing the reaction of those who are actually present. They also remind us that we are all spectators, whether watching a parade, gazing at a city skyline, or exploring a gallery of photographs.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. At the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Spectacle runs through September 7th, while Skyscrapers runs through November 1st.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
When the King of England gave William Penn the land we now know as Pennsylvania in 1681, the state's Quaker founder was intent on building a colony, a holy experiment, that would guarantee freedom of religion for its inhabitants. At a time when people were expected to adhere to the faith of their king, queen, prince, or duke, this religious tolerance attracted many oppressed and persecuted groups from Europe, such as Moravians, Mennonites, and Dunkards. The town of Ephrata in Lancaster County is a prime example of the refuge that Pennsylvania provided for many, and as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the National Historic Landmark, that is, the Ephrata Cloister, tells the intriguing story of one of America's earliest religious communities, known also for its art, music, and printmaking.
Today, the Ephrata borough is home to about 13,000 people. But the town's origins can essentially be traced back to one person, Conrad Beisel, a native of Germany who emigrated to the Philadelphia region in 1720. Beisel's convictions drove him to pursue a hermit's lifestyle in the northern part of Lancaster County. When he moved to the Ephrata area in 1732, it was considered the wilderness, the edge of civilization. Beisel's plans for a solitary life didn't entirely pan out, however, as his charismatic leadership attracted followers. As more and more people came to join Beisel and a group coalesced, they began to institute communal living practices, forming what became known as the Ephrata Cloister.
Start out straight ahead there in the kitchen.
Dressed in a white robe that resembles what the cloister members would have worn, Andrea Hefner is a tour guide at the Ephrata Cloister. She says at the height of the community, between 1740 and 1750, there were about 300 members. The settlement was made up of two main groups. First, there were the brothers and sisters, a group of 80 celibate followers who wanted to live on the grounds with Beisel.
They wanted to dress a certain way, eat a certain way, live a very strict life of self-discipline in hopes that someday they would have the chance to be spiritually united with God in heaven.
Beisel thought that ideally one should be celibate, that marriage was a distraction on the path to God. He directed the brothers and sisters to dress in a uniform, monastic style of clothing, white robes that would hide the earthly body. But not everybody that joined the community wanted to live the celibate lifestyle. And so there were also many married members in the settlement who chose to live in the surrounding farmland and support the commune. Beisel named this tranquil community Ephrata, after the town of the same name mentioned in the Bible, a suburb of Bethlehem where Rachel, the wife of Jacob, died giving birth. Though today the cloister has 28 acres with 9 surviving buildings, in Beisel's day, the commune sprawled over 250 acres with about 40 buildings. The architecture of the original buildings that remain is one aspect of the cloister that makes it an especially notable historic site. Curator Carrie Moan says with various methods of construction used for the buildings, like the printing office, Beisel's house, and the large women's dormitory, there is no collection of colonial-era buildings like this in North America.
There are some surviving half-timbered buildings around here and there, although they're very scarce today. There are certainly log buildings around. There are stone buildings around from the mid-18th century. But it's the total grouping of these buildings in this context that's unique.
Moan says another significant part of the community was the books and artwork that the society produced. At its zenith, the cloister had the largest printing operation west of Philadelphia, a complete publishing center, which included a paper mill, printing office, and book bindery. The cloister produced its own publications, but also printed for clients outside of Ephrata. Moan says many of the cloister's books and walls were decorated with some of the earliest North American works of Fraktur Schriften, a Germanic calligraphy.
They had their own distinct style about it. They spent their time composing large wall charts with biblical sayings or sayings by Beisel. They decorated book plates and other books and used that form in different ways, you know, as a way of expression and of denial and regimentation and discipline, where the journey was more important than the end result.
The disciplined cloister lifestyle that called for celibacy, monastic garb, and learning the art of Fraktur Schriften pervaded all other aspects of life for the brothers and sisters. For example, their sleeping patterns had strict guidelines. They would sleep on 15-inch-wide benches with a small block of wood as a rather hard pillow. The brothers and sisters would only sleep about 6 hours a night, for 3 hours at a time. They'd wake up in the middle of the night for a 2-hour prayer service. The work days would start at 5 a.m., and including about 4 1-hour-long prayer sessions, would last until about 6 p.m., dinner time. Incredibly, they only had one main meal a day. Then, after dinner, it was off to lessons. The cloister residents capped off their day with either communal writing lessons or singing lessons. Conrad Beisel loved music. He often led the singers himself, and he wrote many hymns. The cloister as a whole produced hundreds of songs. Susan Schober is the former president of the Ephrata Cloister Associates, a volunteer organization that helps preserve the historic landmark, and a member of the Ephrata Cloister Chorus. The choir was formed in 1959 to interpret and keep the music of the cloister alive.
I guess I like to know that I'm a part of keeping that tradition going.
Schober says Beisel wrote a treatise on how to harmonize music. So whoever wrote music on the cloister property had to follow his guidelines.
He had never been formally trained in music. So his guidelines had more to do with spiritual things. There were like master notes and servant notes and things like that. So it's not conventional music.
Schober says because they don't know exactly how this music originally sounded, it wasn't composed on paper by traditional methods, the choir is not out to recreate the original cloister music. They're more interested in helping to tell the cloister's story. This story extends beyond the cloister's heyday in the mid-1700s. Though after Conrad Beisel's death in 1768, the society quickly declined, and the last of the celibate members died by 1813, the town of Ephrata sprung up around the cloister. In 1941, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania acquired the surviving elements of the historic site and began a program of restoration and interpretation. Highlighting the story of one of America's earliest religious communities, today the cloister is a place to not only learn about the rich heritage of the unusual lives led by Conrad Beisel and his followers, it's also an opportunity to explore the groundbreaking legacy of Pennsylvania, a colony built on traditions of religious tolerance and freedom under the law.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The Ephrata Cloister in Lancaster County is open to visitors year-round. Morris Arboretum artist-in-residence Patrick Doherty works mainly in one rather unusual medium. His large flowing sculptures are typically composed of interwoven tree branches, twigs and saplings, materials he gathers close to the location of his works, usually a large garden or arboretum. In April, Doherty began work on a now-completed botanical sculpture at the Morris Arboretum, and we dropped by to observe him at work. So, this looks to be a lattice work of what plants are in here? What are these all creepers? Are they vines?
They look like vines, but they really are small saplings, and anywhere from 1.5 to half of an inch or a quarter of an inch, and we weave them in. I had to figure out what birds and beavers already knew, and that is that sticks entangle easily. And it's really the simplest method of joining. If you drag a stick to the woods, everything entangles in it. And so that's the method that we're using to hook this thing together. If you want to think naturally, you could think that we're making a snail shell. If you're a party person, you could think we're making a layer cake here.
The thing it does actually remind me of is an inverted bird's nest. Is that fair?
Well, it will have some of the same qualities of a bird's nest, and but it's, you know, for me, I'm a sculptor, so I think of it as there are lines with which to draw. So any using your body like a pencil and all the conventions of drawing, you have to accumulate these sticks in interesting ways. What you're seeing here in front of you is basically our starting point of building a structural base on which to work. And so this is our first layer and also the first kind of level of this, what will be a kind of an architectural folly. And then you've got sticks sticking up to the sky, really long sappers that are sticking inside it, and that becomes the second and third layer, which is to be determined. We haven't worked on it yet. So
well, that's what I was just going to ask you. What's dictating the shape of this?
My inner psyche. No, I've a little bit of a drawing, and also have an idea about the way it should feel and the way it should work. It's a spiral, and you spiral into it. with plenty of doors and windows to escape. So people can bring their children and not get rid of them. They can find a doorway out.
Do the different trees and saplings and branches, do they have different properties that lend themselves to particular uses?
They really do, and I'm learning about the sticks that I have to work with. This piece I'm holding here is a Norway maple, and there's some alder there and some willow. I'm seeing willow and red maple and some red twig dogwood. And so I've got lots of different things, and I'm trying to still understand the property and how to get the most out of each stick. We just got some really nice larger lines from nearby, and I'm working those in around the doorway there. You can see I've got some bigger pieces, and it's the combination of larger and smaller lines that really make an interesting surface.
There is a history to this as a craft and as a practical application as well, in that people have been making fences like this for years and years.
Well, we have a shadow life of hunter and gatherer in us. I mean, millions of years ago, that's all we did. And if we were thrown back into it tomorrow, we'd all know just how to go get something and build us a place to live. So, you know, there is a deeper resonance with sticks and people, because we're basically creatures and animals, and we know how to use this material. So But in contemporary times, or not so distant, before Lowe's and Home Depot and other box stores, you know, you had to go to the woods. Your grandfather got tool handles out of the woods. So there's fencing, wattling, and wattle and daub, where you're putting it in the wall. There's baskets, which is a contemporary use of sticks, you know, a huge use of sticks. And it's funny to go to France and see villages that only raise sticks. That's all they do, and they have bundles of what I like everywhere. I'm having heart palpitations. Oh my God, look at that. I could do this, I could do that with these sticks.
While we're looking around here, the only thing we're seeing is scaffolding, some ladders. One of your helpers is standing on an upturned plastic flower pot.
Dick, don't do that.
You talked about the Home Depot and Lowe's. Are there any circular saws? Are there any tools going on here? Or is it all purely manual in the pure
sense? It is. It's a way of, we've got our, the way I start is to set scaffolding around the piece and then pull the shape I like. So you see, this piece looks like it's tied up like a circus tent, because I'm pulling all different places back to my scaffolding and trying to hold a shape. And then as I firm the stick work up, then we just go through, we start cutting. We cut all the strings out, they all come out, and then we'll start our second layer. We'll go up there, tie it all up, work over it, cut it loose, go to the third layer, you know, similarly.
And when you cut it loose, does any of it spring to a shape that it's decided on?
No, it usually stays where we want it to. I mean, occasionally we're unpleasantly surprised.
And the question that people ask painters a lot of the time, how do you know when it's finished?
Well, you know, what we all do is set parameters for our work, and so we polish and refine, and that's where I'm at. And at a certain point, there's no percentage in any further refinement.
And conversely then, because of this is all natural material and it's all native to this area, are you happy to let it just rot away, or do you want to take it down because you want it to be as beautiful as it can be all of its life?
Well, that's right. When you have work in public, you know, the next person that walks by doesn't really know what its history is. There is some beauty in watching something kind of fall to a, you know, its beginnings as soil, you know. But generally work in public, and particularly sculptures that don't have much precedence. People are not just normally used to seeing a sapling sculpture sitting right somewhere. You just have to be kind of careful about the line between trash and treasure, and this stuff is very thin. And so one minute it's great, the next minute it's looking kind of disheveled, and you take it down.
Morris Arboretum Artist-in-Residence Patrick Doherty. His latest botanical sculpture is now on view at the Morris Arboretum in Chestnut Hill. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under Rosson Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.